أعوذ من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، ولعن الله الدائم على أعدائهم أجمعين من يومنا هذا إلى قيام يوم الدين. السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. Respected elders, brothers and sisters, I begin the lecture this evening by first expressing my condolences to our living Imam and to all of the believers and the lovers of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. When we come to these gatherings, it's important that we're here not just with our bodies, not just with our minds, but also with our hearts. The stories that I like to begin the lecture with, or the ahadith I quote, are for the purposes of reviving the heart. When we come to these gatherings, it's an honor. It's tawfiq from Allah. It's an opportunity that He created for us. And it's important that we acknowledge this and feel the gratitude in our hearts. And by doing so, Allah says, "La in shakartum la azidannakum." If you thank me, I will give you more. We're told that one time, two of the companions of Imam Ridha alayhi salam came to him. One of them, his name was Ahmad, the other was named Al-Husayn. They come to the Imam alayhi salam, they're devout followers, they love him, he's their leader, but they have a complaint. So when they go to him, they say to him that, "Oh, our Imam, life used to be good for us, but things have changed recently. We're going through some tough times right now. So could you make a dua so that things go back to the way they were before?" And one of the things we're told in numerous traditions from the Ahlul Bayt is that the Imams are always praying for their followers. We're also told that they're aware of what they're going through. And we're told that when we go through struggles, there's particular attention that our Imams, as their job as being our leaders, that they are aware of those particular struggles that we're going through. In this case, Imam Ridha alayhi salam wants to test them. And I know that many of us, when we're coming to these gatherings, for a period of time, we're here and we're transported to a different world where we hear about these great ones, our heroes, our loved ones. But what we're putting aside are sometimes some deep problems and challenges that we're going through. And we're wondering that, can we find a relief from these problems? So these two men asked the Imam, "Is there some way that we can go back to the way we were before?" The Imam asked them a question. He says that, "Do you wish to be kings on this earth, but that you should lose ma antum alay?" Ma antum alay is an expression in hadith which means that you should lose your wilaya of the Ahlul Bayt, meaning that you lose your faith and your adherence to the guardianship of the Ahlul Bayt. Are you willing to give up your being a Shia and to become a king on the earth? They told him emphatically that, O Imam, even if we were to be given the entire earth filled with gold and silver, we would never, ever want to give up our faith and our being adherence to you. The value of knowing the Ahlul Bayt, the value of having them be our role models, our leaders, of having them be our heroes, is something which is very precious. And these two men knew it. So the Imam alayhi salam was happy with their answer, and now he wanted to advise them. He says to them that, he quotes to them the verse from the Quran in Surah Saba 34:13, where Allah Ta'ala says, اِعَمَلُوا آلَ دَاوُودَ شُكْرًا وَقَلِيلٌ مِّنْ عِبَادِيَ الشَّكُورِ O family of Dawood, act in a way that you are grateful, and how little of my servants are grateful. How few of them are grateful. So first of all, he advises them you should have an attitude of gratitude. And then he goes on to say that have a good opinion of God, because somebody who has a good opinion of God, God is with them where they put him. Meaning that, let's say that we say that, okay, we're trying our best. We've identified our faith. We're working towards it. Sometimes we make mistakes. We get back up. We seek forgiveness from God. We're trying to do our best. If things are a little bit tough for us, we shouldn't think that God has abandoned us. Allah Ta'ala tests us because He wants us to rise to higher stations. We should be reflecting on what we could do to improve, make amends, but we have to have hope. And when we have hope in Allah, then Allah is there for us. Point being that, brothers and sisters, when we come to these gatherings, this is an opportunity for us to not just be here, but to be here with our hearts and to be filled with gratitude that we have been chosen to be, inshallah, counted among those who mourned and grieved and participated in these gatherings to, inshallah, make our lives become more Husseini, more like Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Our topic over the last few nights has been the enlightened journey of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The reason why we went back in history and looked at certain people like Ahnaf ibn Qais, like Usama bin Zayd, the reason why we looked at the historical treatment of religion was to understand how Jahiliyyah had crept back into the Muslim society at the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. How an era of ignorance and a lifestyle of ignorance had set back into the Muslim community. And the reason why we want to understand that is because there's this burning question, which is how could this ummah allow the grandson of their very prophet to be killed and martyred while so few were supporting him? But the question we're having is not just historical. We want to connect it to our present times. That's why we've been making these connections with attitudes and ideologies and actions that people do in the modern era. Tonight, inshallah, my topic has to do with the Jahiliya custom of barbarism, meaning being somebody who just kills and oppresses other people. And I'm going to, inshallah, make a connection between how that was revived at the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and how we're facing the revival of barbarism in the modern era as well, and what we can do about that. You all know that the Jahiliyyah period was, meaning the Jahiliyyah period before Islam, was one which was filled with like the worst type of behaviors. People eating the worst type of foods, having the worst type of relationships. But maybe the most outstanding characteristic of the ignorance of the period of ignorance is the amount of killing that took place and the complete lack of respect for lives. People who study that period, they say that generally speaking, people's religion was very, you know, not organized. There wasn't any like set of like aqaid, like usul ad-din, like principles of religion when it came to the people of Jahiliyyah. But if you wanted to say they had a religion, and if you wanted to say what was the one rule in that religion, it was the rule that if somebody attacks you, you must take revenge on them. So we're told that, for example, one of the wars that dragged on for decades was caused by the camel of one tribe going to the pasture of another tribe and grazing on their fields. And when the other tribe saw that the camel had come, they fired an arrow and the arrow hit the hump of the camel, and this began an entire war. And the war continued to the point where the people who were originally involved, they had left this world. And now their generations after them were fighting, and some of them had even forgotten what the reason for their fighting was. It was filled with complete lack of respect for life. And then we have the revelation of Islam. Allah chooses those people and He sends to them our Prophet. And our Prophet brings them life, real life, by telling them who is a human being and how should human beings be treated. In the Quran, Allah Ta'ala says in Surah Al-Anbiya, Surah 21, verse number 107, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وما أرسلناك إلا رحمة للعالمين. O Prophet, we have sent you as a mercy for the human beings. Before, they were filled with the complete opposite of mercy towards one another. But now the Prophet comes and teaches them another way of approaching things. The Quran is revealed, and in Surah Ma'idah, verse number 32, Allah describes the reason for why human lives are precious. He says, مِنْ أَجْلِ ذَٰلِكَ كَتَبْنَا عَلَىٰ بَنِي إِسْرَائِيلَ أَنَّهُ مَنْ قَتَلَ نَفْسًا بِغَيْرِ نَفْسٍ أَوْ فَسَادٍ فِي الْأَرْضِ فَكَأَنَّمَا قَتَلَ النَّاسَ جَمِيعًا وَمَنْ أَحْيَاهَا فَكَأَنَّمَا أَحْيَا النَّاسَ جَمِيعًا. That when it comes to killing a human being, the reason why it's prohibited when it's not for a just cause is because it is the equivalent of killing the entirety of the human race. Now, I don't know if you've had a chance to ponder upon this. Why does God equate one with many? Because one is equal to one when we look at it mathematically. One life for one life. But here, when we look at what Allah is saying here, He's saying that when you kill indiscriminately, when you kill unjustly, there's no reason for it. That act that is taking place is an inhuman act. It is below the dignity of a human being to take that sort of action. And so what you're doing is you're actually warring with humanity itself. You're challenging the status of a human being as a dignified entity on this earth. You're basically saying that human beings need to now be reduced to the level of animals. That's according to one interpretation. But on the other hand, وَمَنْ أَحْيَاهَا فَكَأَنَّمَا أَحْيَا النَّاسَ جَمِيعًا, that whoever gives life, it is as if they have given life to the entirety of human beings. So we see that during the time of the Prophet, there is a new order, a new era that is established, one of respect, one of forgiveness, one of peace. Warring tribes come together as brothers, and you're familiar with the stories. But not too long afterwards, the Umayyads come to power, and now some of these same traditions that were there, the ugly head is now being reared again. So we find, for example, Muawiyah, la'anatullahi alayhi, it's quite amazing. You know, at his time, they had established a society which was a caste society. You had the free people, and then you had this group called the Mawali. The Mawali were mostly from Persia. And they were treated as like second-class citizens, or even worse, sometimes more like untouchables. If, for example, a free person was walking, the Mawali had to walk behind them. They couldn't make contact with each other. They couldn't, you know, operate as brothers and sisters or anything like that. They were given the most lowly of professions and jobs to do. And history says that Muawiyah, you know, being a governor, when he found it inconvenient to have a large number of Mawali in his cities, he would just order that the excess should be killed. Just go and take care of them, get rid of them. Because he didn't want to deal with the expense of dealing with them. For economic reasons, he would say, we're just going to kill the excess. But the crimes don't stop there. We see that the governors of Muawiyah, in the city of Kufa, the governor, he causes so much blood to be shed that they say that the population of orphans visibly increased leading up to the time of Ashura. Meaning that we're talking about the, you know, this is the time period of the reign of the Bani Umayyah. Right, Muawiyah at the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam up to his Shahada. Right after that, Imam Hassan, and now this is what's happening. More than 8,000 people were killed during his time. We're told that this barbarism was such that, for example, Ziyad, the father of Ubaydullah, Ziyad, when there was a woman who was protesting his policies, what he does is that he orders that she be killed. But before she's killed, they do something to her body to mutilate it. And then the body is hung in the marketplace as a warning for everyone. This is 2 years before the tragedy of Ashura takes place. And these types of killings, now, normally you would think that people have a conscience. They would react to this. They would say that we don't accept this because we have a standard for right and wrong. But perhaps, you know, one of the worst examples of people being apathetic and silent is when it comes to the example of one of the companions of Imam Ali alayhis salam, where when he goes and he refuses to do la'an on Imam Ali alayhis salam, he refuses to curse Imam Ali alayhis salam, he's killed by Muawiyah. But in order to support his killing, he gets the signature of 70 noble men from Kufa to support what's happening here, even though they knew that this was unjust. They don't want to speak out of fear of what Muawiyah is going to do. Shurayh al-Qadi, this is something that's quite shocking. Shurayh was a judge. He was somebody, they say, you know, he might have been a companion of the Prophet, but maybe he was born after the death of the Prophet. But he had become prominent during the time of the second Khalifa, as he was known to be like a judge. And he was a judge in Kufa at the time when, you know, Yazid comes to power and he wants to kill Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So you're familiar with the story of Hani ibn Urwa, one of the really good supporters of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Hani is imprisoned by Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad. And in prison, they beat him, they abuse him, right? He's not being treated in a decent manner, and eventually he's killed. The family of Hani ibn Urwa, right? His cousins, his, you know, brothers, his father, everyone is there, right? They're gathered around Darul Imara, the palace, and they're worried about Hani's state. And they're threatening, they're saying that, look, if you don't bring us Hani, if you don't assure that he's safe, right, we're going to do something. So what does Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad do at that time? He says that, okay, you know what? I'm going to have Shurayh al-Qadi. He's the judge. He's going to go and see Hani, and then he'll come back to you and he'll tell you what Hani's situation is. When Shurayh goes and sees Hani, Hani tells him that, tell my people that they've done this to me. Tell them to come to my rescue. This is unfair, right? They've beaten me. They've, you know, I'm wounded. I'm sick. Like, to help me. Shurayh comes out, and history says that he is intending to pass along the message. He has an amana, after all. It's a trust. He's intending to pass along the message. But what happens is that he sees that one of Ubaydullah's spies is there. He's watching what's taking place. And because of that, he just goes and tells his family that I went inside, and I saw that Hani ibn Urwa is fine. Nothing's happened to him. Now, brothers and sisters, historical experts, those who analyze history, they say that this particular testimony, which was not fair, it was something that was a lie. They said that had Shurayh only said the truth to the family of Hani, at that moment, his family would have gone and rescued him. It's very possible that this would have led to Kufa being under the rule of Muslim ibn Aqil, And eventually, it would have been possible for Imam Hussein alayhi salam to go to Kufa. And they say that for at least 6 months, Imam Hussein alayhi salam would have been in power in Kufa. And what contribution would Imam Hussein have made to history? Of course, I mean, his contribution is unmeasurable, and you know. But what else would he have contributed had he been in power as well? They say, they question this. They say, they muse over it. They say that what would have happened? This could have been a turning point in history. What was the reason for this? Just a feeling of not wanting to be under pressure because of the spy of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad. So what are we looking at here, brothers and sisters? We're looking at the return of a culture of killing, of prisoner abuse, of detaining, of treating refugees in a second-class manner. We're looking at a return of complete apathy, where people are not doing anything in face of the injustice that is in front of their own eyes. And what does this lead to? It paves the way for Karbala. Because when these rulers are doing one thing after the other and they see that the reaction from the people is mute, they're not speaking up, they're not protesting, and they say that, well, if I could do this, then I can do something even bigger the next time. So that was the culture that had set in back at that time. What about now? This is what I want to look at our current time. Please, you can help me with the salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Brothers and sisters, in our time that we live in right now, there is a widespread notion generally that's spread that, look it, right? As long as you're a decent person, you're okay. Right? Just live your life, right? Don't kill anyone, don't murder anyone, follow the law, right? But go ahead, enjoy yourself, right? Live your life to the fullest. Just be a decent person. If you want to be religious, go ahead and be religious. If you don't want to be religious, then just be a decent person. And a lot of people, that's kind of the way that a lot of people think about it. Even when they look at other people, they say, look, as long as that person is a decent person, then that's good, right? I don't really want anything more from that person. It's a widespread type of understanding of things. Now, there's something which is called the myth of the decent person. And you can go and Google it if you want when you get a chance and read about it. And the myth goes something like this. That let's say that this person who is a decent person, they live their life like that. They don't have necessarily a strong commitment to an absolute set of values. They're just kind of in their own circle. They do their own thing. They don't bother other people. They're looking down. Let's say they were to die. They leave this world. They live their life. And now it has come time for them to be judged. Okay? Now, that person will say, look, I didn't do anything. I didn't harm anyone. I wasn't barbaric. I didn't, you know, hang anybody after mutilating their body. I was just doing my thing. Right? So let's just say that we take that person and we say, okay, fine. No problem. Are you willing to just answer some questions from somebody else? Sure. Okay, who's going to ask me the question? Well, let's take the person who is the oppressed person. That oppressed person, you can take them from, there's a lot of places you can pick that oppressed person from. You can take them from the slums of one of the cities in the countries that we live in. You can take them from, let's say, those who, you know, were unjustly imprisoned in one of the countries we live in. You can take them from the many countries which have been subject to the exploitation of the world powers. Take somebody from Yemen, take somebody from Palestine, take somebody from Syria, whatever. And you just say, okay, can you answer some questions? Right? You are living a life as a decent person according to your standards, but tell me, when I did not have enough food to serve my children a meal, where were you and what were you doing? How did your decency affect me in any way? Right now, you're aware, maybe you're not aware, that in Somalia, half of the population does not have enough food to eat. Mothers are burying their children alive out of starvation. What answer are you going to give to that person from Yemen who was killed, whose house was destroyed by weapons made by the biggest companies? Because militarism has become an industry, a big, big industry. It's part of the modern world. And what answer are you going to give when that person comes and says that, okay, you led a decent life, you were concerned with your own affairs, you didn't go and kill somebody or bother somebody, but tell me that couldn't you have done something to prevent my house from being destroyed? Some word said somewhere, some change in policy, some raising awareness. These are important questions. Somebody from Palestine might come and say that you led your decent life, but tell me that couldn't you have given my struggle a voice? Couldn't you have fought against this idea of normalization and say that it's never normal to oppress? Didn't you have the skills, for example, on social media or on, let's say, journalism or public policy or law or international law to do something to help my cause? And then the decent person might start to reflect and say that, you know, maybe I could have done something. And this is a question I want to ask ourselves, because we're here to try to understand what expectations Imam Hussein alayhi salam has for us. What did he stand for? What did he stand against? What culture was he fighting? What was the culture that allowed him to be killed? We don't want to be part of that type of culture. You know, brothers and sisters, sometimes when people start feeling a little bit concerned and care about what's happening in terms of the barbarism of this world, they look at the stats. They say that, look at, in World War I and World War II combined, we had more than 70 million people killed. And maybe in World War III, which maybe is around the corner, we're going to have another 40 million people killed, or maybe even more. They look at the stats about how politics and the military industry are, they work hand in hand. And they get really worried about that. And they say that, look, we need to do something. So what do? They say that, well, let's approach the humanitarian agencies and let's say we're going to, you know, support them with our charity. Now, I want to make a comment here that there are people out there who are doing humanitarian work where they're the real soldiers. Like, they're amazing, right? They sacrifice so much, right? We have people of all sorts of professions, even from this community, from other communities, right? They really have given their lives to fight against injustice and to spread justice, and I really admire them. But after all, we come to these gatherings to try to like deepen our understanding, right? I want to share with you a very insightful event that took place once. This was from the late 1990s. There was a group of UN delegates that were doing relief work in the Middle East. They were tasked with like providing aid to victims of earthquakes, victims of other natural disasters, war, famine. And what they were doing is they were going on a fact-finding mission. They wanted to understand more from the countries themselves to see how they could better help the Middle East, in particular the Muslims in the Middle East. So they were making their tour and they were going to different countries. One of the countries they visited was the Islamic Republic of Iran. And they were mostly based in the capital city, but then it was suggested to them, it said that, look, you want to understand more about how you can do charity work and humanitarian work, why don't you go to the city of Qom, because after all, that's one of the centers of knowledge of Islam, and speak to some of the scholars. So they said that, well, which scholar should we speak to? And it was suggested to them that you should go and speak with Ayatollah Jawadi Amali, hafidhahullah, one of the greatest of our scholars who's alive. May Allah protect him and preserve him. They request a meeting, and this was kind of last moment. And so Ayatollah Jawadi already, you know, he's a, mashallah, a very busy person, very productive. It's just tremendous productivity and contributions to the scholarly tradition. So they managed to find some time with him. They go, it's a delegation that is comprised from people of different faiths, different countries. And they're here to learn about the perspective of Islam when it comes to doing humanitarian work. When Ayatollah Jawadi finds some time to meet them, it's very brief, because he was already booked with different classes, he's teaching other responsibilities. But I heard this from somebody who was present at that gathering itself. He says that Ayatollah Jawadi came, he greeted them, they sat down, and he told them that, "I understand that you are people who are busy doing humanitarian work. You're working for the sake of human beings. And you're here to help when it comes to things like famines and natural disasters and warfare. The work that you are doing is like the work of a plant." Because what does a plant do? When you cut off like one leaf from the plant, the rest of the plant gets active and it goes and tries to mend that leaf that's broken off, it's cut off. And soon enough, you'll see that a bud will form and then the leaf will come back again. And that's the job of a plant. It, when it gets cut, it gets damaged, it comes together, it gets active, and it restores. He said that work you're doing is like the work of a plant. And in that way, he was trying to say, he's not trying to demean their efforts, but he's saying that this is the reality of it. But what about if we were to think of what would happen if we try to see charity work and humanitarian work in the capacity of animals, which are even more sophisticated than plants? Or even beyond that, when it comes to human beings. What does it mean to actually do humanitarian work as human beings? He says, you've come here, and one of the things that you're lacking is an understanding of who a human being is. If you want to do work with human beings, you should understand who a human being is. A human being is more than just a body with bodily needs. A human being is a creature with a soul, and that soul is connected to the divine. Without a proper understanding of the divine nature of a human being, how can you possibly help a human being? Without an understanding of a human being, how can you possibly understand what it means to do injustice to a human being so that you can stand for the principles of justice? Because if you understand that, then you'll understand that injustice involves more than just taking away food or cutting off food supplies. Injustice is sometimes done at a much bigger level. When you veil human beings from truth and reality, you cut them off from that which gives them true life, the true teachings, the true principles of how to be a human being. You see how Ayatollah Jawadi Amali, Hafidhahullah, is trying to get them to think at a deeper level. Sometimes it's convenient for us to follow, let's say, social media celebrities who say that support this cause or that cause. You know, change your profile color picture on your social media account and show your solidarity with this cause or this event or that event. I'm not saying these are things which are totally bad or haram or something like that, but I'm saying that there's an opportunity here for us to reflect that what is the true injustice taking place in this world and what can we do to address that. And so I want to come back now to bring it back home. I want to make it practical, inshallah, for a few minutes, and then we'll move to the masail. But you can help me with the salawat on Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. When it comes to our understanding now, we're trying to say that in the modern world, we have a resurgence of barbarism. You know, under the guise, like, you have people in suits and ties who are sometimes, in terms of the, if you look at the stats, the number of people they're responsible for killing, the number of children they're responsible for killing, or those children they're responsible for causing their malnutrition, is much more than the likes of Muawiyah and Yazid. What is our responsibility? And what I want to say, first of all, is that we need to break the myth of the decent person. Being decent is not just that I take care of my own things, I don't try to bother someone else. No, I need to understand what is my responsibility at a larger level. One of the comments I want to make tonight is to our younger generation, although it applies to those who are older as well, that though the powers that be, those who want to continue with their aggressive stance, those who want to continue oppression, exploitation, one of the things that helps them is when people are silent. When people just stand by and let them do what they want to do. And one of the things that they facilitate in order for this to happen is to make people, especially young people, whose hearts are actually very much alive and would very much respond to the call of help from those who are being treated unjustly, one of the things they do is they try to make them distracted from their purpose. They make them busy with other things so they forget about what they were actually supposed to do and who they actually were supposed to be. One of the beautiful sayings we have from Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, he says, لا تكن عبد غيرك وقد جعلك الله حرا. Don't ever be a slave of somebody else when Allah has made you be a free person. Some of the things which might be appealing to us at first glance, if we go and look at the nature of it, it's actually a modern form of slavery. It's a form of addiction. Smartphones can do a lot for us. They can help us in so many ways. But they can also be a source of addiction. Social media can be a source of addiction. Music can be a source of addiction. The entertainment industry can be something that occupies us so much that we forget about what we were all supposed to be about. So my message for our younger audience in particular here is that embrace your identity as an abd of Allah, as a servant of Allah, and understand your potential. Don't sell that for something which is cheap. Don't sell your time and your abilities for something which is way below you and your dignity. You have so much to offer as an individual. Allah says in the Quran, وَمَنْ أَحْيَاهَا فَكَأَنَّمَا أَحْيَا النَّاسَ جَمِيعًا. Even if you are able to give life to one soul, it's as if you have done an act for the entirety of humanity. Sometimes we think about the situation right now and we're like, oh, we're so deeply entrenched in the system that pretty much there's, no matter what I do, it's not going to make a difference. That's not the way that God does things. The way God does things is that He looks and sees, it's almost like He's looking for an excuse for to take action and to show His mercy and to make things change. But He needs the agents of change. Those who are going to be like our Prophet, they're going to be agents of mercy. What does that mean then? It means that I need to see what I can do as an individual. What do I have to offer? You know, one of the things that's very important is when we know that we have a purpose, which is a greater purpose, that can help us to make decisions in a different way. If we set our sights low, if we think that, oh, my life is just about being a decent person, just involved with my own personal things, whatever like that, then I set my sights low as well. But when I understand I have a greater purpose, then that informs my decision. How am I going to study? I'm not going to take my studies just lightly and just fool around. I'm going to take it seriously because I understand that this is one of the steps that I'm going to take to be able to actually make a change. When it comes to choosing my career, I'm also going to think deeply and reflect upon this. That what is the best way that I can do something to actually help the situation? Not be party to it. At the very least, I want to choose something halal. But beyond that, can I do something else? Maybe it's through the creation of wealth, that's also something which is noble. Maybe even the way that I do my occupation, it can actually be something that can transform the world. I can be responsible for going against the system of barbarism. There's so many areas in which we find that we're falling short in, where we don't have the people who we need to in order to actually make a change. These are things that we need to study. We need to have, maybe we already have them, we need to continue, have more of them, community forums where those who are aware, they pass along this knowledge to those who aren't. I need to be careful about who I take advice from. Sometimes there are those out there who unwillingly or willingly, they actually encourage our youth to not live up to their potential. They say that, oh no, it's okay for you to just, you know, take things easy and just find something which you don't find. If you're finding it challenging, don't take that challenge. Just take the easy route. No. Of course, everyone needs to understand what is it their strengths, where are their weaknesses. We also want to encourage and say that, look, you have a responsibility. Right? You yourself could be an agent of massive change. You are a Husseini. You have something to offer to the rest of the world. How can you get that potential? Don't sell yourself for anything cheap. So we want to be conscious about how we use our time. how we use our efforts, what decisions we make. Well, we want to be part of a solution. And at the end of our lives, when that person from Yemen or the person from Somalia or any other place, if they were to question us, we can say that, no, I did something. I used my position and the blessings that I was given to actually work towards a greater cause other than myself. And inshallah, this will be something that will be pleasing to the Imam of our time as well. Ajallahu farjahu sharif. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Brothers and sisters, tonight we want to now move to the Masaib portion as we are entering the third night and beyond. Our thoughts and our hearts go to the field of Karbala and the events that took place there. We know that leading up to the martyrdom of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, the great companions of Imam Hussein alayhi as-salam showed their sacrifice first. There's no way that they would ever let a member of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam be killed before they themselves showed their sacrifice. There's a story that's told of one of the great scholars. He says that I was studying about the history of the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi as-salam. And the thought came to me that on one hand, we're told that they were the best of companions. We have that in hadith. Imam Hussein alayhi as-salam says that this is the best of my companions, the best of companions of all time. Right? We say we laud them with so much praise in our ziyarat. Assalamu alaykum ya ansara abi abdullah. We say that you are this and this. We say ya laytana kunna ma'akum. If only we could be with you. Fanafuza ma'akum fawzan azima. And we could achieve that great success with you. He said that I was reading about these and thinking about them and I started to doubt. I said that, well, after all, you know, they were in that position and the grandson of the Prophet, the son of Fatima, is here and he's being attacked by the enemy. Right, what else would you do? Right, would you just like run away from the battlefield and just leave him alone? Of course you would go and give your sacrifice. Anybody who has any love for the Imam would be able to do such a thing. I'm wondering, why is it that they are of such a high status? And then they say that when he slept, he saw a dream. And in his dream, he's taken to the plains of Karbala. It's the day of Ashura. And he's in the presence of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And he says to Imam Hussein that I'm at your service. Imam Hussein says that when the enemy fires their arrows, you be my guard. He says, gladly, I'll do so. So he's there ready. And the enemy fires the arrows. And as it comes to him, he sees that involuntarily, he ducks when the arrow comes. And the arrow strikes Imam alayhi salam. Astaghfirullah Rabbi wa atubu alayh. How could I let that happen? This is an act of cowardice. I won't let it happen again. But when the second arrow comes, he ducks again. And the second arrow strikes Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The same thing happens again. He turns to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. I'm so sorry. I meant better. I wanted to do something, but I couldn't stop myself. Imam Hussein alayhi salam smiles at him and he says that indeed, my companions were the best of companions. They were the most loyal of companions. As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah wa ala al-arwah allati halat bifina'ik. يا ليتنا كنا معكم فنفوز معكم فوزا عظيما. Peace and blessings be upon you, O noble companions of Imam Hussein. Those who gave everything for the sake of Allah, for the sake of defending the grandson of Rasulullah. One of the companions that I'd like to remember tonight was named Sa'id al-Hanafi. Sa'id ibn Abdullah was one of the people from Kufa who was not scared by the threats of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad. When he saw that the situation was getting difficult, he became more active. He began to raise funds, rouse the people, telling them that we have to go now to support and defend Imam Hussein. Many did not listen to him, but he was determined. Sa'id ibn Abdullah al-Hanafi joins Imam Hussein alayhi salam on the way to Karbala. We're told that on the 10th night of Muharram, Sa'id ibn Abdullah al-Hanafi is one of the first people to speak up defending Imam Hussein. He says to him and all those who are gathered, "O my master, if I were to be killed and my body were to be cut into pieces, if I were then to be burnt and my ashes were strewn in the land, and that happened 70 times one after the other, I would never give up defending you and being with you." But sometimes we say these words, but when it comes to being tested, we falter, we fail. But there are those who are true to their pledges, those whose faith is entrenched, and Sa'id ibn Abdullah is one of them. On the day of Ashura, we see that when the time for Dhuhr Salah comes, Imam Hussein alayhi salam has to say his prayers. But the enemy will not relent, they will continue to fire their arrows. What is going to happen now? Sa'id ibn Abdullah al-Hanafi says, "Oh my Imam, I will be your shield. You go ahead and say your prayers." Imam Hussein begins, "Allahu Akbar." The enemy fires their arrows. One of them comes to Sa'id. He takes it with his right hand. The other one comes on the left. He takes it with his left side of his body. One by one, the arrows rain upon him. When Imam Hussein alayhi salam finishes his salah, he turns to Sa'id ibn Abdullah. He sees that Sa'id is lying on the ground. He's feeling the pain of the arrows. But Sa'id is not going to die just like that. He has a question for his Imam. We have the same question for our Imam. أَوَفَيْتُ يَبْنَ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ. Have I been faithful to you, O the son of the messenger of Allah? O Allah, curse these people the way you curse the people of Ad and Thamud. O Allah, send my salam to the grandfather of Hussein. Tell him that I bore this pain in the hope of your reward. But my question to you, O my Imam, is that was I faithful to you? Imam Hussein alayhi salam responds, "Na'am anta amami fil jannah." Yes, indeed, O Sa'id, you are faithful. In fact, you will be in front of me in Jannah. Allah la'anatullahi ala al-qawm al-zalimeen. Wa say'alamu al-lazina zalamu ayyamun qalibin yanqalibun. Matamir Hussein.